This is Business of Home. I'm your host, Dennis Scully. Every week, I'll be talking to leaders and innovators from all corners of the home industry. My guest this week is Emily Henderson, the stylist, designer, blogger, influencer, and most recently, author. Emily's big break came after winning the fifth season of HGTV's competition show, Design Star. Since then, she's built a sizable following, both on social media and through her own website. In our conversation, Emily shared an inside look at what it's like to be a successful design influencer, from negotiating contracts with sponsors to battling Instagram algorithms. We also spoke about the inspiration behind her new book, The Pros and Cons of Hustle Culture, and why she's now focused on delivering value, not chasing followers. This podcast is sponsored by Modern Matter, a designer and manufacturer of statement-making, decorative, and kitchen hardware. Modern Matter offers a customizable collection of handcrafted solid brass hardware featuring hand-polished gemstones. When designing a space, consider the importance of hardware from the beginning. Modern and luxurious hardware makes an impact on any room. Choose from over 500 knobs, pulls, and backplates, in stock and ready to ship. Visit modernmatter.com to see how the company is redefining hardware. That's modern-matter.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Room & Board. Room & Board is a trusted resource for furnishing homes with modern, artisan-crafted furniture and decor. And now, business and industry professionals are turning to them to help furnish offices, hotels, restaurants, and other commercial spaces. When you work with the Room & Board Business Interiors team, you can access their commercial discount program, 5 or 10 year product warranties, free warehousing, and more. Visit roomandboard.com for ideas and inspiration for your next project and learn more. And now, on with the show. So I want to give listeners a broad understanding.
Okay.
Of the early days for you and sort of the turning points in your career, because some of our audience members will be familiar but not know in detail everything about you. So do we go back to the small town in Oregon? Where do we go?
I think we do, only because there are a couple things of note. I mean, I'm sure there's more than a couple things, but so born and raised in rural Oregon, and my parents had six kids and we were raised way out in the country, and they were Mormon. So I was raised Mormon, which one of the things I love so much about the Mormon church, which I am not anymore, but is their industriousness and their productivity. And there's a real make not buy attitude, which is awesome. So I think that that definitely, you know, informed my design aesthetic a little bit, and also just it got me into it. And that was before, I mean, in the 80s and in small towns, nobody knew that you could be an interior designer, you know? I mean, it was really just teacher, doctor, lawyer kind of thing. So I chose teacher because that's what, and both my parents were teachers, so that's what you do. And went to college. And meanwhile, you know, we had been thrifting since we were little, more for necessity than, you know, six kids, teacher salary, like obviously thrifting. Thrifted a lot. I was always drawn to, you know, things that were really funky and really different. And, you know, not good, but vintage.
Didn't actually look good together, but I felt excited about
yes. So went to college, studied English and history at U of O, and then I still didn't know what I wanted to do, but I moved to New York afterwards knowing that maybe New York would help, and which of course it did. So the first couple of years in New York, I was walking dogs during the day. I was bartending at night, and then I started working at Jonathan Adler as a shop girl kind of in between. Like there was a couple of years where I was doing all three of those things, which was a pretty great combination. Walking dogs is a lot more fun than you might think it is. I really enjoyed it. Anyway, so after a couple of years, I was like, well, I didn't move to New York to be a permanent dog walker on the Upper East Side. So that's when I started working more at Jonathan Adler and meeting stylists that would come in, and they, you know, were just shopping. And I was like, what are you doing? And they told me that they worked for magazines and catalogs, just borrowing and shopping and making things to style out the sets. And that sounded like a whole lot of fun to me. So I reached out. I wish I still had this cover letter that I wrote, because I wrote a pretty epic cover letter to all the stylists that I knew, because I had no skills. I had no experience. Before there was any exposure, if you're in a small town, there's really no exposure to design, truly. So I just knew I liked it. And I think that's why I was so drawn to Jonathan Alders, because he was just so quirky, you know, like he was just such a rebel.
Yeah, yeah. And remind people who might not know Jonathan Adler. And Jonathan Adler was, this was in the very early days, and he's mm-hmm. spinning his potter's wheel, and he's, right? And he's just kind of this fun, very hilarious artist. And
so back in the day, and still currently, Jonathan Adler's whole aesthetic was a bit, you know, irreverent and fun and vintage inspired, and a lot of, remember those like animal lamps that he made, like big pottery blowfishes? I was just so drawn to it. I just remember going to the ICFF trade show just by myself. I bought tickets just by myself, and I was wandering the booths and found his. And I was like, I want to work here. So I think I applied like a week later and got it, at the time he was there every day. So it actually was a really special position. I was just a shop girl,
sure.
But it was cool to be around him every day.
Yeah.
So I assisted for a few years. No, not a few years. I assisted for 5 years, eventually, you know, quitting the dog walking, Jonathan Adler and the bartending and did it full time. And then we moved to LA. So I got, Brian and I got married. We've been together since college, moved out there together. And then he wanted to move to LA to kind of follow the acting gold rush. And it was unfortunately about 2 weeks before the writer's strike, which if anybody remembers that, it shut down Hollywood for years.
Devastating.
So both of us were, you know, in Santa Monica in this back house, kind of floundering and watching a lot of HGTV and feeling pretty depressed. And that's when I auditioned for Design Star. So they had, you know, their big ads for it. And Brian's like, you should do that. And I was like, that's ridiculous. But I was just bored, you know? And I was like, if anything else, it'll be a really fun story, just the audition process, which it is crazy. And then I got on and ended up going to New York for 6 weeks to shoot the season that I was on, which was really, I've since written about it. I couldn't for years, you know, because it was a really tough season, which I don't even know if you care about, but there was no design producers on it. So they would basically give us $500 and tell us to go to Macy's and give us like 9 hours to produce a room. And the room was based on how it was these really esoteric themes. So it was like the way the saxophone makes you feel. And you're just like, wait, what? And they're like, yeah, that's why it's a challenge. So they were ridiculous challenges that were obviously very hard to make look good. And they didn't look good. We all looked really bad. Somehow near the end, we were talking to the producers. They were bummed at the quality of the design. I was like, well, yes, you're giving us no money, no time, no resources. You're not going to get a good room. And I was a stylist in New York. And so they're like, well, what would you do? And I was like, and I gave them this massive list of stores. And I was like, this is where we need to go. And so in the last few episodes, that's when they kind of shifted. And I was able to, I mean, probably because I went to my favorite stores, honestly, like I was able to pull out some actual good designs and I won, which was just very exciting, you know. And then I came back, and what you win is the opportunity to have your own show. And mine was called Secrets from a Stylist. It was kind of the heyday of, like, styling had just become a buzzword, you know. This is 2010. And so I think that the network and society, they didn't have anybody was talking about what to do with your stuff, basically, like, you know, so, and that's what styling is. It's you have all these pillows, like, how do you put them on the sofa that they look good? And you have all these books, like, how do you put them on a shelf to make it look good? And that's what the show is mostly about, is as helping people understand and find their style and then implementing it into their space.
Did you have a sense at the time that winning this show was going to turn out to be this incredibly big deal I mean, did you think at the time, oh my, this is about to set me off on a career path?
Yeah, I did. Design Star back in the day was a really big deal to win. And they definitely, I mean, I just remember feeling like, oh, they're treating me like I'm really important. Just even the PR team and just the way they handled me. And so it did feel like a very big deal. Now, I will say the best thing that I did and have ever done is I started the blog in 2010, January 1st, 2010. So when I was doing Secrets from a Stylist, I would make sure to shoot the spaces afterwards, and I would hire my own photography. I would blog about it throughout the week. I was shooting probably 60, 70 hours a week. I mean, it was a lot. It was 6 days a week. And the only time I had to blog was in hair and makeup at 7 a.m. So those of you that have been reading the blog since then, I mean, thank you, because the grammar mistakes, the run-on sentences, it was just me. And it was me fast. It was me 30 minutes, press publish, go, you know. But I'm so glad I did, because it really, people that wanted to know where to get something from the show, they're, you know, they're seeing it on HGTV, then they would go to the blog and be able to, you know, to find it. And so then they became daily readers even after the show ended.
Well, and tell me about the blog and what it was about for you in the beginning, because it's important to you throughout your career and perhaps even more important to you today in some ways. So tell me what it was about.
The blog began really as just a personal journal about design and aesthetic. The first couple of years, it was really just like, hey, do you guys like aubergine? And then I would, you know, put a bunch of photos of purple and talk about whether or not I'm into purple. So I think that people enjoyed the voice. I don't know why else they would come back. You know, like, it took a while for it to be good. And then after, you know, again, Secrets from a Stylist, being able to blog about that content was showing real original content. And then after the show ended, then I shifted into doing more residential clients, and then I would blog about those as well. So anytime that there was any sort of update, I just turned it into a blog post. And it was, I think, one of the reasons it was successful is because of the sheer amount of posts that I created. So I blogged 5 days a week for, I mean, since then. But even at the beginning, there was nobody coming, but I really enjoyed it. That's why I kept doing it.
Well, right. But that's the hard part about the blogging, right? In the beginning, you feel like you're alone, practically talking to yourself, and you don't know if it's resonating with people. But then one day you discover you do have this, turns out to be this incredibly loyal audience that's found you and likes you and wants to, as you say, sort of hear from you every day suddenly.
Yeah. And in a lot of ways, people still come up to me and they'll say, you know, it's so weird. I feel like I know you. And I'll say back, you do. I was so myself on the blog. And, you know, these days, honestly, I'm a lot cagier because privacy, internet, it's gotten different than it was 10 years ago. But I truly was myself and still am on the blog. And I write about my true thoughts and feelings. And so I think that because people, I'm kind of in their home every day on their laptop, there was just a real connection.
Perhaps in part because you appeared to be so honest with people, right? You always sort of came across as so real and sincere, and at times you were vulnerable, at times you were sort of joking, and you weren't ever taking yourself so seriously, right?
I hope you're correct. But yeah, I always tried to just be
let's go with that.
Be myself and be, you know, transparent and vulnerable. And do you remember when everybody said the word authentic for a decade? But truly, at the beginning, we didn't even have to say the word authentic. You just were, you know. It wasn't something you had to try to be in the beginning. But yeah, that's how I felt. I was just like, if I'm just myself, we'll see what happens. And it's always seemed like the easier way to go. Same with on TV. People are like, you know, I obviously didn't have any TV training. Nobody really does. But it was just so much easier to be myself than try and be a host.
So you did Secrets of a Stylist for a couple of years, right? And then was there a conscious decision that you made to move in a different direction Tell me about that.
So Secrets from Stardust got canceled along with a lot of their other design shows when the revolution of real estate renovate shows came about. And understandably, like the Property Brothers, basically, it was just so wildly popular. So it's not that they canceled. They're like, we're going to take a second to try and kind of, I think they're looking at all of theirs to see if they can reboot it to be more like the Property Brothers, basically. I did more shows after that, but they were mini series. They weren't my show. I was just more acting as talent on camera. And so I was picking up residential clients and I was starting to get my first partnerships. And then it became pretty clear that the blog was going to be successful enough that I didn't really think about pursuing it for a while. But I would say about 3 or 4 years later, that's when I started turning it down. And that's mostly because of time and money. If you are the design and on-screen host, it's easily a 50-60 hour week. I mean, easily, which is fine if you don't have kids or maybe if you're trying to build your career. But at that point, I think I had Charlie and I wasn't going to leave my family for that long for the money. Like the money is just not good enough.
And tell us what the money is. I mean, what?
So like a few $1,000 an episode, basically. Yeah. And you're doing right. All the design and the on-camera work and a lot of the creative work. I had a pretty good experience with Secrets from a Stylist because it was before I had kids. I did get a lot of partnerships from it. It was a huge launch pad for me. I was really glad I did it. It definitely helped me get, you know, Target. And Target is like the partnership you want, you know? So I owe a lot to them too, but they wouldn't have, you know, it was between the blog and Secrets from a Stylist is how they even found me. So
let's talk about that. And as we sort of transition into kind of explaining what the business goes on to become for you, the partnership with Target, and they approach you and what do they say they want to do with you? How do they want to partner with you initially?
So initially it was PR spokesperson. It was kind of talking to the press at certain times, using their product in my photo shoots and in my home. And that was kind of it. And then as the partnership grew, which it did, it started being just more on the marketing side. And it was just really successful in so many ways. And I will forever shop at Target. I love them. But I mean, I think that what you're interested in, and I think what a lot of people want to know is how do you make money doing this? Like, how do you, especially with the blog, like, are you interested in that?
Yes, I'm interested in how you grew this business. To the outside world, you seem to have this creative juggernaut. You have close to 1 million followers on Instagram, and you have this wildly successful blog that we've been talking about, and you have this celebrity and air about you as someone who has figured all of this out. Well, the truth might be a little different, that's what it appears. And so, yes, I think listeners would love to hear, how did you grow this? How did you build this? And how did it go from wondering if anyone was reading your blog to suddenly, yes, you've got HGTV shows, and then you've got Target showing up at your door, and then you're hiring teams of people and doing all sorts of things.
Yeah, I think that once partnerships became a thing, so you know, with influencer marketing, which probably didn't start until, like 7-8 years ago, there weren't that many of us that had a team of people or the ability to have high quality photography done and do high quality work. So we became pretty busy pretty fast, which was awesome. So there was, I started hiring and kept hiring. And then when social media it was clear that we had to start really investing in social media and really caring about it, then I had to expand in that realm. So not only am I blogging and I have interior design clients and still doing, you know, some major partnerships, but I'm doing a ton of small partnerships, meaning just social media partnerships, and having to keep up on Pinterest, Instagram, and Facebook. And all of them seemed very important. So it was really hard to figure out what to let go of. And we just didn't. Like, I just didn't. I was in the middle of building this career, and
sure,
I was building, hustling very hard and with the hopes that it would pay off. And so everything was a top priority, and which, you know, I think you can see where that ends up is there's something called burnout. But it was, you know, it was years of a really hard hustle and not saying no to anything.
We're taking a quick break from the show to remind listeners about Room and Board. Room & Board offers modern contract-grade furniture for hotels, restaurants, multifamily housing, offices, and more. From a $79 flat rate delivery to free warehousing and commercial discounts, their dedicated business interiors team provides proactive expertise in account management every step of the way. Whatever your next project is, count on Room & Board to deliver the perfect mix of modern style and long-lasting furnishings. Visit roomandboard.com for inspiration and learn more. And now, back to the show. So tell us what a day in the life would look like for this hustle that you're describing. What were you doing every day?
Every day was different, but most of it was planning photo shoots around partnerships or social media. So there might be one at my house that's like a fashion review, which we do for affiliate sales. One of the revenue streams that's pretty good is what's called affiliate. So it's a commission system that influencers can do to make money off of stuff that they recommend. Basically, if I recommend, you know, this sweatshirt, and if I genuinely like it, I don't mind telling people about it. Then if people click on it and purchase, we get a very small percentage, but that's very small percentage of the cost of it can add up. So we found, even though it was an interior designer or a stylist, we found that people would buy fashion much more frequently, which makes sense. Like, they, you know, they, people need sweatshirts more than they do multiple lamps a year. So we started building fashion into my week because it was pretty lucrative and it was easy. You know, putting together an outfit is a lot easier than putting together a room. So it just became kind of dumb not to. So every week there was normally like one or two fashion. There was a couple small partnerships. So small partnerships might just be a swipe up to like a bedding sponsor, or, you know, they were always pretty aligned with my life. You know, we said no a lot, but just most of the partnerships we said yes to were just solid yeses. They just made sense. Either that they were aligned with me personally or aligned design wise. And it just would seem crazy to turn it down. And it was all fun work. It really was, you know, shopping and styling sets for photography and videos. I love doing it. It became a lot. And I would say that where it all changed was with InstaStory, because InstaStory made it so the content that you created had only lasted for 24 hours. And so you felt you always had to stay on top of it, or the algorithm would make you unseen, which is true. So once the algorithm started messing with all of our feeds, it's become a pretty hairy game since then. It's frustrating because, you know, you create all this content, but unless you play their game, and when I say they, I mean the social media gods, then you don't get seen. And so that's where I think the burnout can happen for a lot of people, which had happened for me, is I was just trying to chase likes and chase follows to stay growing. And to, you know, and there's this extreme pressure on creatives in the internet world to become a brand. And then beyond become a brand, it's then just grow your brand. And it's if you have a following, it's like, why would you not try and grow it and maximize it? And these are all things that are good to do, but the pressure to become big is there, even if you don't necessarily want to, or maybe that's not how you see your future, or you don't identify as, like, people always called me a creative entrepreneur. I'm like, I don't identify as an entrepreneur. I like styling and I like writing. And just because I've grown a business doesn't mean I'm an entrepreneur. And then they're like, oh, don't, you know, you just have such imposter syndrome. I'm like, I don't. It's just not accurate. entrepreneur means you're trying to, you know, you're driven by growth of a business, and that's right. Great. It's just not accurate for me. And as my team got bigger and the business got bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, I think that I'm not alone in saying this, like the work became less enjoyable because I didn't have time to do the what I actually started doing, like what I love so much about it. And it was trying to run a business as a creative with no interest in running a business is, as you could imagine, the amount of mistakes made were huge and embarrassing and disappointing and consistent and unrelenting. And like, it was just...
How so? I mean, what sort of mistakes were being made?
I think around 2019 is when... So I'd been building and growing and growing, and I'd had a second kid, and the overhead on the company was increasing, but I wasn't looking at those numbers. That's boring, you know? And I was too busy shooting and, you know, in Silver Lake, having like four employees shooting me video and photography and vertical and horizontal. And, you know, I was too busy doing all of that to notice.
To look at the Excel spreadsheet of what was really happening with
because
business.
We were doing so well in a lot of ways, like the contracts we were getting, and I mean I'm so fortunate, I mean, so grateful, but so we were doing so well that I thought surely we're fine, and I kept hiring and kept
must
hiring
be making money.
Yeah.
Well, so how big did your team get?
At one point there was 14 at like all of our happy hours, but I think a couple of them weren't full time, but they were working with us so much that they felt part of our team. Sure. They were just like a styling assistants that we loved. But anyway, so I think I remember taking a photo of a birthday happy hour and being like, oh my gosh, these 14 people are relying on me and I don't know how to run a business. And I like them all so much, but I don't know how sustainable this is, because what I realized is, and what a lot of people in my position have realized, is that it's really hard to scale yourself, right? When your business is yourself, it's, unless you want to go like the Martha Stewart route and have like a billion lines of things, for the partnerships, it had to be me, you know, like no one else could be me. So
that's what they want.
Yeah. And so I had the overhead had grown, and my accountant called, and she was like, checks bounced first, right? So then I called her, she called, and she was like, yeah, you're spending way more than you're making. And I was like, on what? And she's like, on your everyday overhead, just not only, you know, payroll, but like business insurance and health insurance and 401ks and all the other things that go around just trying to, you know, be a good boss, but then also just, you know, marketing, props, just everything, the office, we had a fancy office, and it wasn't sustainable. And so it was a real bummer of a conversation. I felt like a big idiot. And I felt so ashamed, so embarrassed, and I felt really bad for me. Like, I remember being like, of course this makes sense. Why do you think that you would know how to do this? And I had just hired three or four people within the last couple months. And two of them, I mean, I liked all of them so much, but two of them, I was trying to find stuff for them to do. So, because here's one thing about me. I hire people because I like them. And so sometimes, like for one job, I interviewed two people for one position, but I like them both so much. So I just hired them both.
Brought them both on.
Yeah. So that was...
Well, so did you have a business manager? Did you have someone? No.
So at the time I had an accountant who knew my business very well, but no, I didn't. And I've read a lot about this since, and I've gotten a lot of good advice. It's basically companies like mine, you need a visionary and an integrator. And I didn't have an integrator. So the visionary is someone like me that has all these ideas and can be really creative, but I'm not looking at the numbers. It's not part of like how my brain works to think about how to get it all done in the way that makes most sense for the business. So I didn't have an integrator, and I had to lay off two people, which sucked very, very badly for both, all three of us. It was terrible. Like, all of us were bawling, and I felt so dumb. I just felt like such an idiot. I actually haven't talked about it. I've kind of a little bit on the blog, but I just was really embarrassed. embarrassed for a long time that I just didn't know how to, again, run the business. And it wasn't that the business wasn't doing well. It was just that I wasn't managing it well. So I kind of had to look at myself and my future and decide, you know, I could invest in hiring a COO, like an integrator, or I could start scaling back. And I kind of did both in a way. I started scaling back, like after we were done shooting the book, everybody that was on production, they went and moved to freelance. Again, another hard conversation. I love them so much and they're thriving now and they thrived then too, but still, it was still a hard conversation.
Sure, sure.
So just started kind of reducing just to see if my mental health would also get better because I felt like it was just unsustainable is the word I used over and over. I'm like, this is not sustainable mentally. And Brian agreed. Basically, he was like, you're not doing well. I'm like, I know, but the company was doing so well and I was having so much fun in so many ways and I loved my job. It was just a lot. So Sarah on my team, she'd been with me for 5 years. She had a real business mind and she kind of stepped up and became more on operations in addition to, she was a photographer. I mean, she was incredible. So that helped for a while, but I still ultimately knew that I am better with a very small team and just less of everything. So less money, less partnerships, less staff, less work, you know, just if you just kind of scale it down instead of scale it up. And I've talked to so many people in my position. So if you're out there thinking, oh, what should I do? Go up or down? Not everybody is meant to grow in the way that we are told, you know, in our society that we should grow, that we should have more people, more, you know, more employees, bigger office. Like it's okay to not want that. And I was kind of forced that I'm like, I don't want this. I liked having a small business with, you know, just a few people that I could manage well. And, you know, looking at the books, then I do know how to, I can manage this because this doesn't feel out of control anymore because it was a bit out of control. Hustle culture it's very tricky, especially like I think that we've gotten so much better since the pandemic. But before the pandemic, we are just told to go, 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 especially if you live in a really large city like LA or New York or San Francisco, where like everything's really expensive. So in order to feel like you've made it, you have to kill yourself to be able to afford to live there and to keep going and going and going. And I know that during the pandemic, leaving LA, realizing, oh, I don't actually have to be here and that I can do less and I can be smarter with my time and go to way less in-person meetings, do a lot more iPhone shoots instead of booking a photographer and hair and makeup for everything. And it kind of just, the content shifted, I think, in a really good way. My team is incredible. They're still, I mean, they're doing such a great job and we're smaller, we're tighter, we're a lot healthier. You know, I think a lot of, sorry, I'm blabbing. Do you want to say anything?
No. I mean, this is also interesting. And as you say, is so counter to the thinking out there, as you were saying earlier, that of course you have to grow. Of course you have to say yes to all of these opportunities. I remember at one point you were saying yes to a dog food brand and there wasn't even a dog in the house. And right? I mean, there was just this... It was just this momentum that sort of swept you away.
Hustling is a good thing, you know, if you want to. It's like when you let it get, you know, when you let it take over and you find that you're just on a treadmill or on a hamster wheel, which is how I felt. Like I was just producing content to pay for everything, to produce content to pay for everything. And it wasn't, I didn't feel like I was necessarily moving forward, just, you know, just going round and round and round. So the pandemic was obviously a big, you know, break for all of us in that sense, like just looking at my calendar and seeing that I had nothing. Remember that first month where there was nothing? It was incredible. I mean, besides how awful it was, you know, don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But I just remember thinking I had no idea how overscheduled I was, just scheduled down to the second. When now I just felt like I hadn't been able to see clearly how, you know, how hard I was working in such an unhealthy way. So we bought a farm, we moved to Oregon, and, you know, with the attempt of simplifying our life permanently.
So are there brand partners that are coming along with you on this sort of personal journey that you're on? Have you said to some of your partners, listen, I'm moving back to Oregon. It's going to be a different life. And can we do some different things together?
I think right now the answer is yes, because we've really proven the quality of the content that we can do. I'm mostly focusing on partnerships around the projects we're doing. So trying to say yes less to the one-offs that maybe aren't integrated already into my life. I still will say yes to some. I'm not taking anything off the table. I'm open to all opportunities. I really am. Like, I'm reading a lot of books that's like, don't close off opportunities, don't. But I would say that, yeah, I'm more doing partnerships that are aligned with the projects we're already doing. So for example, the farmhouse, I reached out to all of my favorite brands first. And I said, here's what I'm doing. You know, here's when we're going to reveal it. Here's what the content's going to look like. Here's what I've done in the past and how successful it was for these partners, and try to lock in my favorite partners, people that, you know, companies that I feel really good about, both like as people, their company ethos, their product, of course, has to be product that I love. And I'm focusing my attention on those partnerships, but I'm trying to see myself, I should say, as more. Well, I'm 42, Dennis, you know, like and yes. I'm not pursuing TikTok, for instance, currently, not closing myself off to it, but you know, I really want to take the experience that I've had and all the lessons I've learned and hopefully put those out there to help add value to the world and help people with their design, even with business. It just, you know, yeah, I want to empower people, make them feel like they can come to the blog and learn something, which it's always been that way, but I feel like I have more clear focus. So I'm less using my time to just write about anything. It's more just like, okay, what is a problem I'm having designing this farmhouse? And if I'm having this problem, then surely I'm not the only one.
We're taking a quick break from the show to hear more about Modern Matter. Modern Matter creates heirloom quality cabinet and furniture hardware. Their trade program was developed in partnership with leading interior designers and is focused on helping you make your next project successful and unforgettable with trade-only pricing and a convenient sampling program. Mix and match sizes, styles, metal finishes, and gemstones to fit each room's needs. Check out at Modern Matter Hardware on Instagram or visit modernmatter.com to open a trade account and subscribe to their newsletter. That's modern-matter.com. Now, back to the show.
Tell me, and we got into this a little bit with Orlando, sort of when designers who are out there thinking about these partnerships and thinking about these influencer deals, what do those really look like? So you referenced like a tile maker earlier, like, so you're going to use this tile in your home and you're going to talk about it and you really do like it. And I get it. And what do they come to you with to say, here, let's work on this together?
Okay. I love this conversation because I think that it's not out there that much. So every partnership is negotiated differently. And I'm not trying to be cagey. It's true. So we don't have a rate sheet. We don't say, hey, Instagram is 5,000. We take it like each partner is different based on their marketing needs and the retail value of their product. So if I reach out to a company that I really love and I want to use them in this project, what it took me a while to reframe in my head is that nothing is free. Okay. So if I ask, you know, if I reach out to this wood company for awesome wood, they don't just give it to you and then say goodbye. Like, it is likely a year of continued partnering on the deliverables. And by deliverables, I mean social media, photography, video content. Sometimes I even go to where they make it and I document my experience there, come back, put it on the blog. It's all negotiated differently based on the retail price of the product. So for instance, we would obviously negotiate something as big as tile for the whole house differently than a lamp. We're much more focused on our partners. I think that a few years ago, I would have tried to really, you know, furnish a whole house with different partners. And now I'm just like, who are the top five that I want to work with this year, and trying to focus in on them. And they're all in different categories, right? So we're not competing, and everybody feels like they're getting the value out of it that they want, which, you know, is, again, tends to be PR, spokespersonship for it, then social media tagging and love, blog crediting, photo usage, and video usage. And I wrote a post about it because recently about this Portland project that we did, meant to be an investment property that my brother and I did as I would say flip, but it was extremely high end. It was not a flip. And once I calculated up all of the time that it took to not only design, but mostly deliver all the deliverables to the clients, it was far more than, again, I think we're seeing a trend. It was far more than what we...
Turns out we hadn't calculated it properly at all. Huh. I am not an entrepreneur. Why do people keep calling me that?
I'm making it very clear. No, but I didn't know, you know, because we're putting it into the styling and the photography. We're putting so much more effort in than, you know, obviously a normal real estate investor would. Like, the toothbrushes were $14. You know, the beautiful soap by the bathtub was $45 because for the shop. It's all for the shot, sure. You know? But the shots turned out really good. And that this was the Portland project from a few years ago, and the press around it was really great. The partners were very happy. But what I realized was that we were just undercharging, that we, to create the content that we needed to for them, it just cost a lot more than we had predicted. So the Portland project really gave us just a good set of data to then take to our future partners and say, in order for you to have X, Y, and Z, we have to charge this in order for us to not only cover our costs, but profit, which turns out is what you're supposed to do.
That's what you're going after in the end. Profit.
And I've had, you know, I do have help. So it's just taken a long time to learn that.
Well, right. And so that's often so it sounds in the beginning, oh, they're going to give me $50,000 and I just need to deliver on four posts but then suddenly you figure out the mathematics of all the people that are going to be involved in making that happen and everything you're going to have to put in place. And so it's not the gold rush sometimes that it appears, right?
You're exactly right. And you know, you never want to complain about it because it sounds like a lot of money, but it just goes fast if you're hiring the right people to help you execute it, and the right flowers, the right toothbrushes, you know, all those things add up. What I will say, I think that I also don't want to tell people to say no to those jobs where there's no profit margin at the beginning, because you really have to show your capabilities, right? And you have to garner this client list and you have to show your worth. And so I think we spent years showing our worth, and then it's like you show your worth and then you charge a lot for your time.
But now you don't show up for less than...
But now.
What?
Well, we do stuff for free just for people that deserve it for free. Do you know what I mean? Like that's a pretty easy. And when I get reached out to frequently from celebrities, which I just find very, very funny. And
well, so, and what do they reach out to you and want you to do?
They want me to design their house for free for the PR surrounding it.
Stop it.
Mm-mm. Yeah. Nobody that's cool enough to, I would never want to shame anybody anyway, but like if you're out there and listening, it's just, if you can afford to hire a creative, you better hire that creative. So, and what I always say is we are happy to, one even said, I thought this could be your passion project. And I was like, you think your $4 million house should be my passion project? And at the time I was doing, I work with this awesome charity called Pen and Napkin, where we help move people, transition people from out of shelters into homes. And they say the recidivism of them going back on the streets is like 90% gone if you decorate their house. So like we do those. And it's like, that's a passion project. I will always do those for free, but not... You're $4 million.
Not your $4 million house in the hills. Yeah. No, that's not a passion project for me.
At the same time, I would still collaborate with a friend. Like, and I still do that. We do friends and family projects for the blog where, you know, we'll try and do something fast that, and I don't charge them. It's more just, hey, you know, we think basement content will really hit right now. You have a basement that could use an update. I'll just approach my friends and be like, hey, I'll do this as long as I can do it really quick and dirty and make it look better. But I may not have time to get exactly every single thing you want, but also I'm not charging my time. So generally they've turned out very successful for that kind of fun trade. And I really enjoy that. Like, that's so fun to work with your friends.
So what has the work that you are doing turned into? Again, getting back to what sort of led up to the book and sort of wanting to explain a lot of things to people to sort of help them have the language and understand how to speak to contractors, how to not be sort of intimidated by this whole process.
So 4 years ago, I was in the middle of the Portland flip that I was telling you about, the big Portland project, and the Mountain House. Mm. Both of them were massive renovations and neither of them in the city that I lived. So they were challenging in a million ways. I was filled with self-doubt and I was making mistakes and I just felt extremely frustrated by the process. I was still having fun in a million ways, of course, but I was crying in the shower as most working moms do. And I just wish that there was a source, just a book that where I could reference, you know, the four different window treatments or the, you know, the difference between semi-gloss and matte. I mean, all the stuff that I know, but it's better than just like Googling over and over and over. How do you design a fireplace? You know, what is a tread? You know, I didn't know some of this stuff. So the next day, instead of thinking on it, which is probably the wise thing to do, the next day I was like, oh, I've got to write this.
It's
got to
be a book. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it doesn't exist. And understandably, it's a big ask, but not all designers want to really talk about their process or even know how to talk about their process. Right. So, but because I was so trained in HGTV kind of, and blogging and writing about design for so long, I feel pretty good about how I can decipher things down into really digestible tips. So I pitched it to my publisher and then we were off. So the whole point was I just wanted to make less mistakes and I wanted to know the rules so I could creatively break them. And even though I had a lot of experience and I knew a lot, you know, I don't want to say that I was a total idiot, but I just felt like if I was that frustrated, then how is everybody else doing this? Like how is the average homeowner that has a job and three kids and has saved for years for this project, how frustrating must this be for them if I'm this frustrated and I have a full team to support me, you know? So that's why we wrote it. And the first half of the book is kind of a know the language. So it's more about the vocabulary, but with really pretty photos. So, you know, the difference between a deck mount and a wall mount faucet and the pros and cons of both. We walk through the different styles of windows and we specifically shot all of those in different homes. So we wouldn't have to speak to them with illustrations or diagrams, you know, they're real pretty photography. And then the second half of the book is, so you know everything now, here's how it actually, you can see it in each room, and here's how you break those rules. Because if you follow every single rule, if you make the most practical choice at every turn, you might be bored with what you get.
Well, and it's funny how we discovered in this time how often people knew so little about their own homes and clear, right? And you were saying earlier how overscheduled you were. And so many people were the same way and they were traveling and they were never home. And they didn't really know how the oven worked or what these different rooms would be like to spend this much time in, as we all have. And it's funny that a book, the kind of which you're referring to and that you've been working on, so many of these helpful tips aren't out there in a sort of easy to find way, right?
I think so. I hope so. That's kind of why I wrote it, just feeling like there is a bit of a hole in the market. But I think I was telling you that the last final draft was 900 pages. And my publisher was like, this has to be 300 pages, but because there was that much information. And it's funny, but it was really hard, like editing down
six, from 900 to 300.
It was painful because I really felt everything was equally important to get in there, you know? So, which is good. It means that what actually made it is, in my opinion, really, really valuable. And then the other 600 pages, because I have a blog, like those are just now on the blog, or they're going to be for the next few years. Yeah, so we can take what we didn't use and actually repurpose it on the blog. One of the reasons that it took so long to publish the book was because it was supposed to be out mid-pandemic, and I, you know, there was other issues, printing and shipping, all that kind of stuff, obviously, that created delays. But that's when two things happened: is we work from home became a thing, and the book said nothing about work from home. I don't even know if we really addressed the home office, because it wasn't really a thing.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe in some fancy suburban houses, there was a home office, but most houses didn't have a dedicated, anyway. So I think we had a couple of them in the book, but that's it. So that happened. And also I woke up to just the interior design sustainability issue and just how wasteful this designing your home can be if you don't, you know, think consciously about your choices. So I stopped the publishing for both of those things. And I went back in and rewrote it with that in mind. So throughout the book, you'll see different ways to be sustainable. A lot of it's obvious. Some are not, though. Some are like good new ideas that I want people to think about. And then also, yeah, there's a lot of work from home ideas that we didn't even know about 3 years ago.
That wasn't a priority back in those happy pre-COVID days that now we look back on so fondly.
Or do we? Yeah.
Well, exactly. And in many ways, many people are finding that they want to make these huge structural changes in their life as a result of what's happened during COVID, yourself included.
Yes.
You wanted to scale back and pare back. And so I wonder, sort of wrapping all of this up, what does this enterprise of Emily Henderson LLC look like today and sort of going forward now that you've sort of gone through this transition of kind of dialing it back?
I keep saying this to myself, and I want to make sure that it's actually the truth, but we have this big audience, right? We have these platforms with a lot of people following. I just want to add useful value to them. And I think that being, you know, 42, I just have a lot more confidence in my experience. Whereas I think 7 years ago, when I was writing about design, I was doing it in a way of like, well, I don't really know, but maybe this could work. And I think that where I can feel good about being a quote unquote influencer is just helping people in their homes, right? So I love documenting projects because that's a real time way to use examples of, you know, design ideas and design mistakes. So I think I'll always probably be doing that. And then I don't know. I'm very open. My heart is very open to any, I'm not joking, to any possibility. I think that what I just have to constantly watch myself for is the overscheduling and the saying yes, simply because I don't want to let people down by saying no. And I don't, you know, I feel bad turning something down. That's a good opportunity. But what I remind myself all the time is hanging out with my kids is a good opportunity. You know, not like being able to be present during dinner was a good opportunity, because before when I was too busy, I still got home at 5:30, but my brain was not there. I would have to really watch myself to be present. And, you know, the kids were young, so hopefully they didn't notice.
They won't remember any of that neglect.
Like, I was around a lot, but my brain couldn't stop. I was very stressed out all the time. So now it's, I just kind of really, I'm hoping to move forward still with incredible partners, running this blog with all these wonderful followers that are loyal, and aligning all of our work with the values that we have.
But we're not going to see you on TikTok anytime soon, it sounds like. I mean, you were alluding to that earlier. I don't know. Maybe your position has changed from the beginning of the show till now. I don't know. Your heart is open. Is it open to TikTok? That's the question. Is your heart open to TikTok? And I'm not sure.
Yes, Dennis, my heart is open to TikTok. Here's, it just has to, I mean, if you want the real answer is we're going to try to repurpose content onto TikTok, obviously. Like, why not?
We've got 600 pages of this book that we've got. We're going to put that on TikTok. We got
it. I mean, we're trying. And I think that I need to experience the platform more and enjoy it before I could possibly put some brain and time and, you know, money behind creating content there. I think what I don't want to do ever again is just try and chase popularity, because that, I think that can lead to burnout, right? And that's, right. We had to do it 5 years ago because it was part of the business model was growing this following. And it's not that I don't want to grow the following. It's just that I think there was part of me that was probably, yeah, just wanting to chase likes and chase follows and not out of any insecurity. I mean, probably insecurity. Everything's out of insecurity. But, you know, I mean, not because I don't think I knew. It was more just like, well, I should, right? This is, I should be growing. And this is what the brands need to see growing. They need to see, you know, bigger and better engagement. And so I just really try and focus less on the numbers, just put out what I want to put out. You know, obviously, if we can see some trends of like what's working, what's really resonating with people, then great. But just trying not to dictate what we do to just get, you know, likes and follows. It's a dangerous game.
Exactly. It's a dangerous game because it turns out you get very emotionally involved in all of this. And as you were saying, and joking but not joking, you come to sort of question your worth and you, right? And you're sort of, oh, well, they liked this, they didn't like that. And it's the ups and downs of this popularity contest, as you were saying. And we talked about this with Orlando as well, this whole, you think it's all stardom and bright, shiny, and it's going to lead to great success. And then For poor Orlando, it was all this sort of heartache and things that couldn't happen and deals that fell through and working in ways that he ended up not feeling comfortable in. But it sometimes doesn't deliver on the promise, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Having a public life also can be challenging, right? So if your personal life is tied to your public success, you know, people know, I don't know. It can be very, very tricky, which I think more and more people are seeing it that way. Like 5 years ago, everybody wanted to grow their brand. And I know so many people now that are trying to stay small in a good way, because there's a lot of vulnerability with getting bigger with the internet being the way it is right now. Right. So people aren't as nice on the internet as they used to be. So, so I think the design followers generally are awesome. So, and I don't care if you don't like what I'm doing design wise, it's more just like, you know, the personal attacks that can be a bit of a bummer, but yeah, I think there's enough people that are like, actually, I just want a following that is, maybe I'm not going to be, you know, paid a lot of money for partners, but a following of people that genuinely want to watch what I'm doing and they want to learn from me and they want to, you know, it's more of a healthy relationship. And that's what I keep saying to my team. I'm like, I just want to make sure we always have a healthy relationship with social media, because there are times when it didn't feel as healthy. And so we just have to watch it just like you watch anything in your life. You have to reassess, like, is this working how it should? Are we all feeling good about this? Does this feel like a healthy choice? Am I making good choices? and it's a good exercise to constantly do when you're in the, you know, in a digital media world.
Well, it's so challenging, especially for designers who today feel like they're getting so much work from their Instagram feed, from their constantly putting themselves forward, and they're being told that, oh, we need to see more of you personally, we need to see more of your life, or the behind the scenes, or and all of that, as you say, gets you open that door and it's hard to close. And sometimes people aren't very nice once you start to really reveal yourself in that way.
Yeah. And if there's a lot of designers out there listening that are trying to figure out how to balance between partnerships and, you know, social media and design, know that you are so not alone. I mean, it was so difficult to do both. I mean, I had to eventually stop taking on clients because there was simply no way to manage both sides of the business. And so I ended up, because as we know, client work can be very stressful. So I was looking at the numbers. See, sometimes I look at the numbers every now and then.
Sure, when it comes to client work, I look at the numbers. Yeah. Right? Closely, and I say, no, why am I doing this? Why am I working with clients?
I think it was 2017. And I looked at the percent of the revenue that was coming from the design clients. And it was, I think, 15 or 20%. And I think my stress at the time was a lot higher from the design clients. It's probably 50% of my stress was coming from the design clients. So I kind of made a shift, right? I chose the blog and I chose partnerships. But if you're struggling to do both, know that it's virtually impossible. It's very, very hard.
And so much of this conversation has been around accepting that. Right, mm-hmm. that you can't do it all or have it all, despite all that we're told in our culture today, and particularly hard. And you've referenced your age multiple times during this conversation, and so there must be this additional pressure around your age or where you are in your life with this and having kids or all the other things. I mean,
I think it's just more clarity. I think I'm more just proud of being at an age where I just feel a little bit more just clear on what I want and what's important. And I've done a lot of like existential stuff too, like woo-woo stuff, Dennis, to try and really figure out, you know, purpose and meaning. And that's not something you really think about when you're 27 or even often 33. I think it takes, you get to a certain point, you're like, wait, why am I here? And what is the value that I can add to this world? So I would say that when I reference my age, it's more out of, so people understand, like, I'm not, it's okay. I'm okay with not necessarily growing and growing and growing because I'm entered midlife. Is 42 midlife? Yeah, totally.
Sure.
No, I mean, I say all the time, I'm like, I have 30 more years of creative work, right? So what do I want to do for those 30 years? And I want to make sure that we aren't just doing the same thing over and over because it has worked. And so that's something that we always question. And I always bring to my team, like, are we doing this because it's something that we've always done, or is this how we should really be spending our all of our time and resources? So it's a good exercise, and it's a really positive space to be in emotionally and mentally, to just be able to question and make sure that your work is really aligned with your values.
And the book is part of delivering on that, wanting to help people, wanting to help educate people, wanting to do good and share your knowledge.
Yes. The book feels like just kind of the design educator part of me. And I didn't go to design school. There's a lot of designers out there, as you know, that are far more experienced, better than I, like, I'm not trying to be like the design source. It's more that just trying to distill down my experiences because they have value, even if they're not. I think that's the whole point. It's like, I didn't go to design school, and most people won't, right? Most homeowners don't go to design school before they renovate. So it's just like, if you can't go to design school and you don't want to spend your life on the internet Googling things, maybe this is a source that can help you.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good way to think about it. Emily?
Dennis.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Just a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to keep up with the latest design industry news, visit us online at businessofhome.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, browse job listings, and join our BOH Insider community for access to online workshops, a free print subscription, and much more. If you have a note for the podcast, drop us a line at podcast@businessofhome.com. If you're enjoying these conversations, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps others to discover the show. This show was produced by Fred Nicolaus and edited by Michael Castaneda. I'm Dennis Scully. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.